I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. We have the most expensive healthcare system in the world, paying more for everything, doctor and hospital visits, drugs, medical devices, compared to our counterparts in other developed countries. And while healthcare represents something like 18% of the total economy, all that money has not led to real improvements in the nation's overall health. It's also a hodgepodge of systems. 150 million workers get their insurance through their employer. Then there's Medicare, Medicaid, the VA system, CHIP for low-income children, and then the millions who are uninsured. Healthcare has been a top issue for Democratic presidential candidates, divided over whether to make incremental improvements or completely reform the system with Medicare for All or single payer run by the government. Here's Senator Elizabeth Warren right before announcing her Medicare for All proposal, an edited clip of former Vice President Joe Biden responding to Warren's plan on the NewsHour, Senator Bernie Sanders speaking about his Medicare for All proposal at George Washington University this summer, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg describing his plan back in June.
We need to talk about the cost, and I plan over the next few weeks to put out a plan that talks about specifically the cost of Medicare for All and specifically how we pay for it.
So much to ask you. Healthcare. Elizabeth Warren today put out an estimate for the cost of her Medicare for All plan. She put it at around $20 trillion over a number of years.
She's making it up. Nobody thinks it's $20 trillion. It's between $30 and $40 trillion. Even Bernie, who talks about the need to raise middle class taxes, he can't even meet the cost of it.
The current debate over Medicare for All has nothing to do with health care. We are not in a debate about which health care system is working well or which is better. Nobody thinks that a system in which 80 million people or more have no health insurance or are underinsured is a good system. But it has everything to do with the greed and profits of the healthcare industry.
Here's how I would do it. It's very similar. I would call it Medicare for All Who Want It. You take something like Medicare, a flavor of that, you make it available on the exchanges, people can buy in, and then if people like us are right, that will be not only a more inclusive plan, but a more efficient plan than any of the corporate answers out there, then it will be a very natural glide path to the single-payer environment.
Joining us from the Monitor Studios in Washington, D.C., Margo Sanger-Katz. She's healthcare correspondent for the New York Times. Margo, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much. Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us, Julie Rovner, senior health correspondent for Kaiser Health News, host of their podcast called What the Health. And Julie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, gosh, where to start talking about our sprawling healthcare system. But Julie, let me begin with you. Under the current system that we have, knowing, of course, how complicated it is and how many pieces that are part of the system, who are the winners today?
Well, the winners today are people who are making a lot of money in the healthcare system. It's creeping up towards being a fifth of the economy. So there are a lot of people. And of course, you know, even within that fifth of the economy, there are winners and losers. People sort of in the bottom of the healthcare industry, home health aides, nurses aides, a lot of people who do some of the critically important work don't make a lot of money. But people at the very top who are, you know, working in ways, sometimes not even delivering healthcare, sometimes delivering sort of computer type services or, you know, ways to help other healthcare providers make more money, those people are making lots of money, and they would just as soon not give it up.
Well, Margo, under the Affordable Care Act, which is about a decade old, did it create measurable improvements in our healthcare system?
So I think the good way of thinking about the Affordable Care Act is it took a sort of messy and sprawling and disorganized system, and it tried to fill in some of the holes between the existing programs. So I think by some measures, it did a good job of that. There are a lot of people, estimated 20 million or so people, who didn't have health insurance before the Affordable Care Act who now have it. There are particular categories of people who have pre-existing illnesses who really couldn't leave their jobs in the past because they would have been unable to buy their own health insurance who now have access to comprehensive insurance. And there are more consumer protections. When you buy health insurance, for the most part, you're guaranteed that it's going to cover a full suite of medical services, that there's going going to be a limit to how much you're going to be asked to pay out of your pocket, and many other features like that. But there still are a lot of problems with the healthcare system, and I think principally among those is that because our healthcare system is so expensive, insurance increasingly is asking people to pay more and more, both in the form of premiums, so the dollars that you pay to the insurance company in order to have insurance, but also in the form of deductibles and other forms of cost sharing that make it really expensive when people have a health problem and they go to the doctor. They can get stuck with big bills in those cases too. And those are people who have health insurance.
Julie, these are the underinsured, and if we toss them in with the uninsured, we're still talking about tens of millions of people who are struggling to pay for their health care.
Absolutely. And that's why this is such a big issue politically. It's not just people who don't have insurance. It's people who have insurance but feel like they can't afford to use it. And that number is really growing. We've seen sort of the growth of what are called high deductible plans. Employers provide insurance, but they can't just keep paying increased premiums. So one way to lower premiums for the employers is to put more of the potential cost of health care onto the insured, onto the employees. And so instead of having a deductible of $100 or $200 or even $500, now we have deductibles of $1,000 or $1,500 or $2,000. And that's just way more than most people can afford.
Margo, help us understand the appeal of Medicare or Medicare for all. Medicare for all. There seems to be, at least broadly speaking, satisfaction for those people who use the Medicare system. There is low overhead. It has addressed some of the profitability problems in a private system. How do you see the appeal of Medicare?
Well, I think one important thing to note is that when candidates say Medicare for all and they're talking about a Medicare for all system, they're not really talking about the Medicare system that people over 65 currently receive. They're really talking about a brand new healthcare system. So it is a brand that is beloved and familiar because the Medicare system that currently exists is quite popular, but it's actually a much more expansive and generous program. So the Medicare for all system that both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have proposed would ask people to pay no direct premiums for their care, would require them to pay no money practically at all when they go to the doctor, the hospital, or the pharmacy counter, and it would cover a range of benefits that most health insurance does not include now. So all the kind of usual stuff, the emergency room, prescription drugs, doctor's visits, but also things like dental care, eyeglasses, and long-term care for people who have disabilities or who are old and need help in their home. So though it is a very broad program, and I think there is the appeal, is that all of your medical needs are going to be met, and you're not going to have to pay any costs directly for that care, so there are no surprises, there are no big bills.
Julie, is that too good to be true?
Yes, it probably is too good.
I mean,
to
it
be
sounds
true.
Wonderful, right?
It does. It does. It sounds great, right? Everything is free. And, you know, when you need care, you can get it. The problem with that is that no other country has anything anywhere near that generous. Every other country has some way to have some kind of limit on the amount of care that their citizens consume. Otherwise, they would all end up spending almost all of their country's income on health care. So that's why in some countries you see waiting lines or queues, particularly for elective care. That's a concern. Or some countries have a role for private insurance. Some countries have a bigger role for private insurance. Some countries do charge, you know, patient cost sharing. Maybe they're not thousands of dollars in deductibles, but maybe it's $5 or $10 every time you access a health care service. There are very few health economists who think that it is even possible to have a case where everything is free at the point of service for everyone.
Margo, is that a good place to start? At least put it on the table and say, in a perfect world, this would be our healthcare system, and then you can take pieces apart as it gets closer to reality.
I mean, I do think that we're in campaigning season, not in legislating season. So you could imagine if Elizabeth Warren was elected president and she brought this proposal to the U.S. Congress that there would be some fussing under the hood with the details of this plan, if it could really get off the ground at all. But I do think that it's important to take note that the proponents of this plan, who include these two candidates, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, but also many of the backers and the voters who are excited about this idea, they really are pretty uncompromising in their idea of how this should work. They don't see it as, here's the goal, and we just want to get closer to that goal. They see it as, this is the only way that we can really have a great healthcare system, and that any compromises that we make on these things, except very much on the margins, are going to undermine the kind of fidelity and the moral promise that is in this plan. So it will be really interesting if one of these candidates becomes the president and tries to get a plan like this through the legislature, how much compromising they will be willing to do and where those compromises may happen.
I mean, Julie, it is Senator Sanders really has pushed this mainstream and frankly pushed it in front of the Democratic Party. And he does frame it as a kind of almost like a humanitarian issue, that this is a human right to have access to health care.
Well, and it is, and that's been something that Democrats have been saying for 100 years. I mean, this is not – even the Medicare for All debate, dates back to the late 1980s. But this has always been sort of the push and pull for the Democrats, who do believe that health care is a human right. But it is a matter of, you know, to some extent it is a scarce resource, how to distribute it equitably, that the people who need it can get it. And it is always going to be sort of a difficult debate. And obviously now, since the 1990s, it's been a top political issue as well. And so both sides use it to their sort of perceived advantage, sometimes scaring people about change, which tends to – that worked pretty well in the 1990s when President Bill Clinton was trying to get something through. So it's just – it's this constant push and pull. But the idea of healthcare as a human right is something that sort of goes through the entire Democratic Party.
Margo, why not, though, let's take a look at Canada to the north and say that's a better system than what we have. Let's appropriate some of the parts of that system and bring it to the United States.
So I think Canada is actually a really good country to look at because it's, you know, Julie said there's no country in the world that has the kind of system that Bernie Sanders is proposing. That's true, but I think Canada comes the closest and indeed is the inspiration for his plan. So in Canada, you receive health benefits from the government directly. You don't pay any premiums. You pay taxes to support them. And those benefits cover doctor's visits and hospital care. And you never have to pay directly to a doctor or hospital when you get care. But there are some holes. So the Canadian system does not cover dental care. It does not cover prescription drugs for the most part. So people tend to have some other kind of insurance for their prescription drugs. And this problem that Julie mentioned, where there are often queues for certain kinds of services, is a problem in the Canadian system. If you need an MRI, if you need a knee replacement, if you need one of a range of things that are not life-threatening emergencies but are the types of care that people in the U.S. are accustomed to getting in a kind of timely way, you may have to wait for weeks or even months to get those services. And it is a constant discussion in Canada, both in the provinces that sort of run these systems locally and in the federal government about how they're going to do this, how they're going to make the budgets work, how they're going to tweak the benefits so that they can make it affordable. It's not just a sort of set it and forget it kind of change that they made in Canada
and
when they created the system.
We have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about healthcare. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with our guests about how to break down Medicare for all the various components that have been offered by both Senator Sanders and Senator Warren and some of the health care plans from some of the other Democratic candidates, talking about the cost, the coverage, the feasibility. Margo Sanger-Katz, health care correspondent for The New York Times. Julie Rovner, senior health correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and she's the host of their What the Health podcast. And you can join us 1-888-477-9499. What kind of reforms are you looking for to our healthcare system? Also, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Margo, as soon as you talked about lines, Nicole sent us a note on the point of countries like Canada with long wait times for appointments. There are long lines in the United States as well. I was waiting for that question. You want to respond to that, Margo?
Yeah, I think it's true. And, you know, we sort of ration care in a different way in the United States. So in general, if you want to get an appointment to get an MRI, it's not that hard. We have more MRIs in the United States than we have in Canada. There are plenty of people who are happy to see you. But if you don't have really good health insurance or the particular MRI that's available is really expensive and you have a high deductible, that can be a barrier. And so what we see are that in the United States, there are people who just choose not to get those kinds of elective healthcare services, who, you know, grind it out a little bit longer with a very arthritic knee because they can't afford the deductible in order to get that knee replacement. So it is true that people here decline to get necessary care or wait a really long time. But the reasons are a little bit different. In Canada, I think there are more limits on the supply of services because they're trying to save money. And in the United States, I think there's a little bit more of an issue of the costliness of healthcare that causes people to choose not to get it themselves.
Julie, talking about saving money, and it's, you know, it's hard to talk about a healthcare plan with all these numbers on the radio, but nonetheless, Elizabeth Warren's plan, she says it would cost something like $20.5 trillion over a decade. It's a mix of raising taxes on the wealthy, on businesses. It's also a matter of cutting costs as well. How does she get to this number?
In a variety of ways. One of the big ways that I think hasn't been talked about very much is what I call the maintenance of effort. Employers who currently provide health insurance would have to pay most of what they pay now to the government instead as a tax. States would have to sort of continue to pay their share of some of what they're paying now for Medicaid. There's an enormous amount of money that flows through the healthcare system. It's important to remember that $20 trillion, that would be in addition to what we're already scheduled to pay, which are just, you know, as soon as you get into numbers that start with a T, it's really hard to think about. But basically, she's sort of cutting out the private insurance market and moving that all to the federal government. And so in that sense, it would look like the current Medicare system that we have now. Although, as Margot points out, the program that would be offered, the Medicare and Medicare for All, is really almost nothing like the Medicare that now serves 50 million seniors and people with disabilities.
I mean, Margot, looking at Senator Warren's plan, it looks like doctors and others would be paid and hospitals would be paid less.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that this is one of the advantages that proponents of single-payer systems like Medicare for All often note. If the government is the only one who's buying healthcare services, if they're the only one that is paying doctors and hospitals, they have a lot of power to say what the price is, and they have some ability to pay doctors and hospitals less than doctors and hospitals would choose to be paid in our current system, where they have a little bit more power to negotiate with different kinds of insurance companies. It is also true that Medicare for All would be a simpler system, and so that might mean that doctors and hospitals wouldn't need as many administrative staff, as many billing clerks and people like that. And so it might be, even if the doctor gets a lower fee to see a patient than they get now, maybe they could keep more of that money because they wouldn't have to pay it out to their employees. But a lot of the savings in this plan come from sort of turning down the dial on what we pay to doctors and hospitals. And I think some doctors and hospitals would do okay under this regime. Some of them already do okay with similar levels of payment. But there are others that really are used to operating with much higher rates of payment. And I think that those institutions would really struggle under the system and would have to either make major changes or perhaps see their business imperiled.
What kind of hospitals are those, the ones that get a higher benefit, higher pay?
There's a little bit of variability, but I would say they kind of fall into two big categories. So one are like the sort of fancy research center, high-end hospitals, the brand name hospitals that sort of, you know, win all of the awards for being the best. Because they have these really great reputations and because they do lots of really innovative cutting-edge work, they tend to be more expensive. Insurance companies are willing to pay them higher prices than other hospitals because patients really want to be able to go to that hospital when they have a serious or complex illness. So those are the kinds of hospitals that would really have to change their cost structures a lot. And then there's another category of hospital, I think, which are more kind of small rural hospitals. Some of those do okay with Medicare payments and would be okay in the system. And I think others are really operating on relatively razor-thin margins already. And any diminution in what they're paid could really affect them. And I think those are hospitals that might struggle a little bit more to just change their business model because they're already kind of lean and operating with relatively low rates of pay in the current environment.
Julie, if you look at Senator Warren's proposal, which is fairly detailed, and also Senator Sanders' proposal related to the cost of drugs in this country, Where's the savings? How do they cut the cost of drugs?
They would pay less for them. I mean, that's basically it.
A lot less, right?
A lot less. Yeah. You know, the late Uwe Reinhardt, Princeton health economist, like to point out that every single dollar of healthcare spending is someone's income, and nobody likes it when their income gets cut. I mean, Congress right now is trying to grapple with fairly small types of changes intended to, if not even not bring down the cost of drugs, at least curb the spiraling upward trajectory. And they're having trouble even doing that. Senator Warren would do things like basically, you know, having the government confiscate the license for some drugs if the drug companies won't lower their prices, which I should point out is already law today. It can happen in certain situations. But her plan would make it, I think, probably more a more realistic threat than it is now. There are, you know, there would be some fairly dramatic ways to cut drug spending. I'm sure the drug industry, which is unhappy even with the small things Congress is looking at now, would really object to a lot of the things in her plan.
What about, Julie, what about negotiating prices? That's certainly been an idea.
It has, and it's still an idea, and it's still out there. And of course, you know, the difficulty of negotiating prices, we've been talking about it in the Medicare context, is that in order to have a good negotiation, you have to be able to say no. And up until now, Medicare hasn't been able to say no. So if the drug companies don't know that Medicare can walk away and say, well, we're going to use somebody else's drug instead, and that then what happens when patient wants that drug and can't get it? So this has also been a little bit fraught about how negotiation will work and to what extent it can work.
Here's a question from Neil. I'm worried about the hit that medical research is going to take if bigger pharma companies get broken up. How can we provide affordable care for people while continuing to fund healthcare research? Margo, can I toss that over to you?
Yeah, so I think it's related to what Julie just said. If the government is paying pharmaceutical companies much lower prices than they currently make, then if you are an inventor or you are an investor, you're trying to figure out, you know, what is the next big thing I'm going to put my money into. Right now, I think a lot of investors think, oh, I'll go to a biotech startup. Maybe I can help cure cancer. And that's risky. It might not work out. But if it works out, I'm going to hit the jackpot. If there's no more jackpot at the end of that process, I think most serious economists think that there will be a reduction in the amount of investment in the sector, and there will be a reduction in the amount of new research and experimentation that happens as a result. The Medicare for All plans, I think from both Sanders and Warren, do create some federal funding so that there could be more government research and maybe some prizes and other kinds of incentives to try to compensate for that loss of like the big bucks at the end of the rainbow. But I think it is reasonable to say if the government really puts a lid on pharmaceutical prices and pushes them down, 70% discounts is what Warren is proposing. That's right. Then the drugs that we have right now that already exist would be much cheaper. But we might miss out on some of those new drugs that would be developed in our current environment.
Julie,
Marty,
can I add
to that?
Yes, absolutely.
You know, one thing that's important to remember is that the United States is basically the only industrialized country that doesn't somehow regulate drug prices. And, you know, when President Trump says we're paying for everybody else's drugs, he's right to some extent that this is the only place where the drug companies can basically charge whatever they want and get away with it. So the question is how to stop that without stopping the innovation and the incentives that Margot was talking about.
Is that even possible, Julie, to find some kind of compromise saying, yeah, you can make some money, you just can't make as much money as you've been making in the past and still keep the research going?
One would assume so, but apparently no one has done it yet.
Well, we are talking about our healthcare system. That's Julie Rovner, senior health correspondent for Kaiser Health News, and she hosts their podcast called What the Health. Also with us, Margo Sanger-Katz, healthcare correspondent for the New York Times. And we asked them both to join us on Radio Times because certainly the Democratic candidates for president have been talking and about healthcare reform. There are various proposals that they have offered. The ones that have gotten the most attention are Senator Warren and also Senator Sanders, having to do with Medicare for All, but there are some others as well. You can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get David from Maple Glen to join us. And David, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me on. I've spent a lot of time writing about this industry and have a book that came out about it years ago, reviewed great in the Times. And I just am shocked that we're still off in this, in the weeds, talking about whether this would cost more and where the money would come from. Every other country, developed country in the world, even Switzerland, which has a sort of a for-profit plan, Obamacare, that works, cost less than what our health care system costs, either whether you look at it on a per capita basis or as a percent of GDP. Either way, we come out like spending twice what all the other countries spend, except for Switzerland, which is about two-thirds. And the reason is because they don't have, they've taken the profit out of the system. And so actually there's no way that a socialized approach to healthcare in the United States, whether it's, you know, Warren's or Sanders, would cost more. They'll cost less overall because of the savings on no more premiums, no more company paying for health care. That's why the auto industry built so many of their trucks and vans in Canada.
Well,
the
David,
labor costs are the same, but,
sure, sure.
You know, not the, there's no health care costs.
Well,
workers.
I hear what you're saying, and it is a part of our complex system. Margo, you want to respond to David's comment? He's saying, why can't we do what other countries are doing? And they're, you know, it works, and we'll get a better system.
So it is true what he said, that other countries tend to cover more of their people, and they tend to do it at a lower cost than the U.S. system. But it's important to realize that a lot of those countries set up their current system, you know, 50 or more years ago. So, you know, 50 or more years ago, spending in these countries looked more like spending in the United States. And in the meantime, our health care system has gotten more and more expensive, so that it now is about double per person what a lot of other countries spend. And so that means that it will be difficult to snap our fingers, even if we could establish a system just like one of those other countries, to get the kinds of prices that they get, because it would require so much wrenching change. You know, as Julie said, one person's savings is another person's pay cut. And so we might not be comfortable, for example, paying physicians half of what they currently make. That is not an uncommon salary in some of these countries, to have physician pay be about half of what pay is in the United States. And on, nurses make less. Hospitals are less fancy. They have access to fewer prescription drugs. And so to get from here to there is hard. I think it is very likely that a system like Medicare for All would probably cost a little bit less over the long run than if we just let our current system continue forever. But again, that depends on a lot of the policy choices that we were talking about before. How will we feel if premier fancy hospitals fall on hard times? Will we want to give them a little pay raise, or will we hold their feet to the fire? How will we feel if people have to wait a long time to get certain types of treatments that they don't have to wait for now? Will we hold the line as a government on the budget, or will we pay more? And so it is true that other countries do things more efficiently, and I think there are definitely lessons to be learned from that. But I also think that it is not as easy as a simple talking point comparing our country to other countries might make it seem.
Can I add something?
I was just saying, because we have this hodgepodge of systems, right?
That's right. We don't really have a system. We have something that just sort of happened. But I want to add something about Switzerland, because I spent some time there. And Switzerland actually has one of the newer systems on the international scene. It started in 1996, and it was done by a vote of the population. And it looks a lot like what the Affordable Care Act was supposed to look like. There's compulsory private insurance. You can buy supplemental insurance on top of that. But one of the things I discovered when I went to Switzerland and started traveling around is that their provider sector, their hospitals and their doctors, are really tightly regulated in a way that I'm not sure the health sector in the United States would stand for. So even in a country that looks a lot like ours, which Switzerland does, and they have a big, you know, research, particularly drug industry there, they have really serious limits on how much they pay for health care that I think that people that the healthcare sector in the United States would find distasteful, if not reject outright.
Margo, I'm thinking that if we were to go to some kind of Medicare for All system, it seems, especially when it comes to bureaucracy, that a lot of people would not be necessary anymore. People who have administrative jobs, just sort of taking care of all the paperwork for the system that we have today, would we see big layoffs?
It's a little bit hard to predict. We've never really done something like this before. It certainly seems to be the case that people who work in the private insurance industry now would have to look for a new line of work. And indeed, Senator Sanders' bill actually provides some financial assistance to help those people with job retraining. So it is a kind of disruption that is recognized by the authors of his plan and that they're trying to ameliorate in some way. But then your broader question about what happens to all of the back office staff in your doctor's office, in your hospital, the people who do billing and coding and referrals and other kinds of red tape things, it may be that there will be room for those people to be replaced with more clinical workers. You know, maybe you could have more nurse practitioners in the practice because more dollars have been freed up, and that will make it easier to see more patients and give them better care. But it may not be the same people. There may be some people who work in the healthcare industry now who, under a system like this, would have to find a different kind of job.
Here's a comment from Steve. Can your guest speak to the rural healthcare crisis we're facing? Affordable healthcare isn't useful if the hospitals around you have closed. Julie, about a minute before our second break here, but can you respond to Steve's comment?
Yes, this is a big problem. One of the problems with healthcare in the U.S. is that it is not distributed well. There are places where there are too many health professionals, and there are places, particularly rural and sometimes inner city places, where there are not enough. It's difficult for rural hospitals to sort of keep their doors open. It's been a little bit easier in some of the states that did expand the Medicaid program. That gave them sort of an influx of cash, and some of them have managed to continue to serve their communities. But Congress has been sort of working on figuring out how to shore up particularly rural hospitals for about 30 years, and they're still working on it.
That is Julie Rovner, again, senior health correspondent for the Kaiser Health News. Also with us, Margot Sanger-Katz, healthcare correspondent for the New York Times. And we are talking about our current healthcare system and some various plans, proposals to improve it, to create more access, to cover costs, to cover care. And I do want to talk about Medicare for All Who Want It. That's Pete Buttigieg's plan. You can join us. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Any questions or comments, do stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with our guests about Medicare for All and some of the other healthcare plans that have been offered by some of the Democratic candidates, cost, coverage, feasibility. And again, Margot Sanger-Katz and Julie Rovner joining us from the Monitor Studios in Washington, D.C. Margot, let me go back to you. And Pete Buttigieg talks about Medicare for All Who Want It, essentially saying, here's an option. And if you want to opt into the plan, it will be there for you. And if it turns out the option works better than other plans, then the people will have spoken, and that will be the system that we have. I'm really summarizing in a really shorthand way there. But what are your thoughts about what he's saying?
I think your summary is pretty good. So, you know, the thing about Medicare for All is everyone gets the same thing. And so if you really care about the kind of equality and social justice aspects of this issue, that's important. If you really want it to be free and to be simple, then maybe that's important. But if you only really care about giving people the ability to buy their own insurance and to have it be high quality, then maybe a plan like Pete Buttigieg's is good enough for you. Right. So what he would do is he would set up a government health care plan. Again, it wouldn't be exactly like current Medicare. It also wouldn't be quite as generous as the Medicare for All plan. It would be sort of more like an Affordable Care Act plan. So it would cover a standard set of benefits. There would be some limits on how much you could be asked to pay for your care. And you would have to pay a premium for that plan. The premium would be scaled based on your income. So if you earn more, you pay more. If you earn less, you get more of a discount. And it would be less disruptive because you would still have the option of keeping the insurance that you have right now. If you get insurance through your job and you like it, no one would force you to change. If you get insurance through a state Medicaid program, you could stay in that one as well. And so what he says is this could create a kind of glide path to single payer, that if the government does a really good job, if their insurance is high quality and low cost, and it can kind of outcompete the private options, then people might slowly migrate over there and it would come to cover, you know, most or all Americans. And if they did a bad job, there would still be other options and people wouldn't be forced to change.
Julie, what is Biden offering when it comes to health care?
Well, Biden wants to build on the Affordable Care Act, make the subsidies larger, make them go higher up the income scale. He also would significantly boost Medicare and what it covers now. As we pointed out, the Medicare and Medicare for All is not the Medicare that exists now. Biden also has the idea of having sort of a glide path, if you will, to that everyone would have an opportunity to get coverage. I think both of these plans, his plan and the Buttigieg plan, and the plans from some of the other sort of moderates, the non-Medicare for All right. Democratic candidates, all say we want to get to the same place, which is where everybody has coverage that they can afford, but we want to get there differently. And I think it depends on the lessons that you take from previous attempts at health care reform. The President Bill Clinton tried to do it in the 1990s, and I think it would be fair to sort of describe that plan as being somewhere between the Affordable Care Act, a little more than the Affordable Care Act, but way less than something like Medicare for All. It wouldn't have been that disruptive, and yet the forces who were allied against it did it by scaring people about change. People don't like change. That's the one thing you can see from going through the public opinion polls. So when it got to the Affordable Care Act, the groundwork was actually laid 2 years before Barack Obama was ever elected president. Senator Ted Kennedy had started to sort of get people, get the stakeholders, the health industry into the room and saying, if we do this, what will it take for you to support it? And so basically, when Obama got elected, they had the entire healthcare industry already on board and ready to do something. Even then, it was really hard to get through. So I feel like some of these more moderate plans are sort of taking the politics into account and saying, we want to get there, but we want to do it without scaring people and without really making the health industry furious because they can mobilize and defeat it.
Here's a question from Kaylee. I'll put this to you, Margo. She says, how would the guests anticipate the Affordable Care Act be working now if the Trump administration had embraced and fostered the program versus how they have dismantled parts of it and worked against it at every turn? And even before Donald Trump became president, Republicans in Congress were working very hard to undo the Affordable Care Act. Is there any way to run that experiment to know would we be in better shape if there weren't attempts to take the Affordable Care Act apart?
I think it is a little bit hard to know because, you know, it's always hard to know what the counterfactual looks like. It is certainly true that the Trump administration has taken many actions that have sought to undermine the strength of this program and probably have reduced the number of people who are getting coverage through the plan. But it's also true, and I think this is almost by accident, but they have taken some actions that have actually improved the marketplaces in many states. So they this is complicated. We won't get into all of the details, but they pulled away some subsidies a few years ago for our insurance plans. And I think their goal was to disrupt things. But actually what happened is it led to a new equilibrium where if you're someone who needs financial assistance to buy your own health insurance, you actually get a better deal now than you would have under the old policy. So it's very much a mixed bag. We see, there are a number of states that still have not expanded Medicaid to cover their low income population. I think maybe in a Democratic administration, more of them might have come along. But I think that really has more to do with politics at the state level, whether the governor and legislature want to expand their programs in this way, than it has to do with who is in the White House. So I think these differences are relatively marginal. The Affordable Care Act is still kind of plugging away. We just have open enrollment has just begun for next year's plans. And what we saw is that the plans are still pretty expensive, but the premiums are actually going down a little bit compared to last year. And we're seeing that there are more choices in many places than there were before. So there are some people who have fallen away because they don't know about it or because they've been discouraged by the policy environment. But there still are options and there still are a lot of people who are being covered through this program.
Julia, an email from Betty who says, I was in Australia a month ago and they all seem to carry both government insurance and private insurance. The government covers all costs for emergencies and the private for elective surgery. Everyone seemed happy with their health care. And it does seem, as we look around the world, that people seem to be, if not happy, certainly happier than Americans are.
Yes, I think that's fair to say. And I think Australia is a good example of what many of our sort of trading partners have, which is a hybrid public-private system. Now, frankly, we have a hybrid public-private system, too. Ours is just not very organized, and there's a lot of people who fall through the cracks. Most of the other countries have actually developed a way where you can use both the private and the public together, and it makes sense, and it knits together properly, and people sort of get most of what they need when they need it for a price they can afford. We've sort of managed not to do that here.
Here's an email from Chloe. She says, I'm from the UK and can categorically say that the hospitals in America are not fancier than the ones in other countries. There are one or two flagship hospitals, but there are many that do not come close to the European standard. Margot, can you respond to Chloe?
I don't have enough experience with European hospitals to speak in great detail, but my understanding from talking to scholars who do compare these things is that there are ways in which American hospitals are a little bit fancier. You know, you're more likely to have a lovely marble lobby with a beautiful fountain in an American hospital. You're probably more likely to have great food. And one thing that's easy to measure is that in the United States, you're much more likely to have a private room in your hospital than in many other countries where you might have to share your hospital room with a stranger. None of those things necessarily speak to the quality of the healthcare that you're receiving. Indeed, we see that health outcomes in Europe are really good, and people have, in fact, a longer life expectancy in many European countries than in the United States. So it's not so much about the quality of the healthcare, but I think the kind of perks and fanciness of the facility. I think that there are many places in the United States that feel a little bit more like fancy hotels than the hospitals in Europe.
Julie, there's a wonderful New York Times quiz where there's pictures and you can compare and decide whether it's a hospital or a hotel. And it's hard. I don't know anybody who's gotten 100% on it.
Oh, interesting, interesting. But I guess we know the fountains in lobbies don't necessarily make for better health care. But let me ask you, Julie, about just the chronic health care problems that it seems so many Americans have, whether it's, you know, whether it's diabetes or even the opioid crisis. It seems that we, maybe other countries are as well, are just struggling with these very expensive but also chronic problems.
Yes, and this is one of the things that does drive spending in the healthcare system are people with chronic conditions. Some of them are, you know, behavioral, like opioid issues and other mental health issues, and some of them, like diabetes, can be, you know, genetic or they can be lifestyle. You know, we have seen, Margot was talking earlier about the people who might be displaced if the U.S. were to go to a Medicare for All system, the people who are now doing administrative tasks that might not be needed. You know, we've seen this kind of dislocation before in the industrial Midwest with manufacturing, which, you know, largely moved out of the country. And yes, a lot of people got retrained, but a lot of people didn't. And there are those who say that, you know, that's part of what's led to some of the chronic health problems that we have now, is the difficulty of people who had good middle class jobs who now can't find jobs that pay anywhere near that well, if they can find jobs at all. And it is a concern. And, you know, there's more talk now of what we call social determinants of health, that it's not just the quality of the medical care that you get, it's your housing and your nutrition and your ability to get from place to place. Those things all influence the health sector and health and well-being. And there's more research on it, but it's hard to sort of swallow that all up in trying to think of how we want to reconfigure our medical care system.
Well, even in some parts of the country, the mortality rate is falling, Julie, because of people's health problems. They literally are not living as long as they used to.
That's right. Yeah, there are the life expectancy is falling in some of these places. Yes, it is a big issue, and as I say, it goes further than how we structure our medical care system, and it has much more to do with how we structure our society.
Let me get, looks like Russell from Dublin, PA, to join us, and Russell, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I was just calling. I think that the U.S. government needs to start getting into the business of producing generic medication instead of suing Purdue Pharma and allowing them to file for bankruptcy and not getting any funds. We could have them start to actually produce medication for us at cost.
You're talking about the U.S. government creating drugs, affordable drugs for the public. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. Let me, Margot, what are your thoughts about that?
So I think that for the most part, generic drugs, so those are drugs where there's no longer a patent and anyone who can prove that they can make the drug safely and reliably can sell it, that is actually not, in general, a very expensive part of our healthcare sector because it's really competitive. And so, you know, if you have four or five companies that are all trying to make a generic version of a Lipitor pill, say, they're each going to undercut each other until they get to a price where they can make a little bit of profit, but, you know, not a ton. Where we see the big costs in prescription drugs tend to be in these branded drugs, drugs where there is not competition and someone else can't come in and manufacture them. So some politicians in the Democratic Party think that the government should be able to just take away the patent and either manufacture the drug itself or give the right to other companies that can do it at lower cost. And there could be some savings from a policy like that. But I think
with a few exceptions, in general, having the government get into the generic drug making business is probably not going to be a source of significant savings.
And can I point out that the Purdue Pharma example isn't so much about drug prices. It's about the company's covering up evidence that it had about how addictive its opioid products were.
Margo had listed the healthcare spending for 2020, more than $3 trillion. I'll just run through it. Medicare, $732 billion. This was as of this morning. Households, $931 billion. Medicaid and CHIP, $464 billion. State governments, $302 billion. Employers, $955 billion. That's a lot of money that we are spending on our healthcare. Julie, what do you think could create better outcomes based on the fact that we're spending so much money on healthcare?
Well, it might help if we actually had a system where people were, you know, were accountable to the system. And there are efforts that are going on around the country, within Medicare in particular, to have more value for the price that we pay. Right now, so much of healthcare is piecework, and so much of healthcare is the more you do, the more you get paid, which is just an incentive to do more, even if that more isn't necessarily helpful or necessary. But it's difficult to do in this sense that everybody's accountable to somebody else, but not everybody is accountable to the underlying cost that we as a society pay. And I think that's one of the arguments for some kind of rationalization of our medical care system. I'm not sure. I mean, what form that rationalization will take. But I think sort of both sides agree that those who would want more public and those who would want more private definitely want some more accountability so that we will pay more for value and less just for, you know, whoever can get something out there and make a buck.
Margo, we're going to be having this conversation in another 4 years as we try to figure out how to improve our healthcare system.
I think this is a conversation that we're going to be having forever. I think, first of all, the politics of particularly Medicare for All, but even some of these plans that we're calling moderate now, are really a pretty big departure from how healthcare works now, and they're going to require a lot more government financing of healthcare. And so I think that means that they are not a sure thing. Even if one of these candidates wins the presidency, even if Democrats take control of the Senate, neither of which are guaranteed, I think it may be difficult to make these kinds of very large changes to our system. But even if we did it, this is ongoing. You know, we have had Medicare in this country since 1965, and every single year, Congress makes little changes to it because they're trying to save money, because they're trying to improve the kinds of services that are included. And, you know, the healthcare system itself is going to keep evolving, and our federal budget is going to keep evolving. And so I feel that Julie and I will continue to be employed for the foreseeable future, writing and talking and thinking about this issue.
Julie, incremental? Is that sort of what is that the future?
Well, it's been incremental. I mean, at some point there may be a larger push, but it's hard to see, you know, something like, and there are people talking about, well, if Sanders or Warren got elected, we'd have Medicare for All next year. That seems increasingly unlikely.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Julie Rovner, thanks as always for joining us on Radio Times.
Of course.
And she's senior health correspondent for Kaiser Health News, host of their What the Health podcast. And Margo Sanger-Katz, thank you for joining us as well.
It's so nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And she's healthcare correspondent for The New York Times. And we appreciate all those calls and comments to the show as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including a podcast of the program. Diana Martinez, your engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.